Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage EDUCAUSE 2013 Program Committee Chair, Loretta Early.
Good morning. Can I ask those of you here in Anaheim to welcome our colleagues who have joined us online in the virtual conference? And let me offer my own words of greetings to day two of the 2013 EDUCAUSE Annual Conference. I also want to personally give a big Boomer Sooner welcome to my OU colleagues online, as well as those of my team that have joined me here this week. First, I would like to express my great appreciation for everyone who made day one such a success, especially our presenters, conveners, volunteers, sponsors, and the EDUCAUSE staff. I've enjoyed working with all of you tremendously. I hope our EDUCAUSE alumni have reconnected with colleagues and friends, welcomed our newcomers, and continue to be energized by our community. I hope our newcomers have discovered opportunities to make new connections, explore some uncommon solutions, and most of all, to be inspired by the passionate people and innovative ideas that make this association possible and so valuable. Welcome to day two. Be engaged and excited about the possibilities and the difference you can make as a leader in information technology and higher education. You may have noticed that EDUCAUSE selects an important issue for focus each year. Last year it was analytics. This year it is higher education in the connected age. This conference explores this issue in many ways. But to give you a better idea of what we're talking about, let's listen.
Connecting is a powerful metaphor for IT and higher education. Anyone and everything can be interconnected. People, resources, data, ideas. Linked and tagged, tweeted and texted, followed and friended. As we become more connected, can higher education be better than we could have previously imagined? It's complex and messy in a bring-your-own-device, do-it-yourself learning, there's an app for that world. Yet it promises agility, flexibility, and personalization, and anyone can participate. Our connections create relationships. Our relationships create communities of faculty, of researchers, of learners, of institutions. Higher education is a connected community, and connections can do transformative things. When education is connected, it forms a pathway. Formal and informal learning are no longer separated. Learners can connect to an ever-widening circle of mentors, peers, experiences, and knowledge. Games, simulations, collaboration tools, and augmented reality can help learners connect the dots in ways never before possible. Progress to degree becomes visible with data-driven dashboards. Success is improved with alerts and interventions. Gatekeeping need no longer apply in the connected age. It's about the choices, possibilities, and pathways in front of us. New business models are possible in the connected age. Open education resources and peer learning change the cost equation. Competency-based models and prior learning assessments allow learners to get credit for what they already know and pay only for the education they need. With MOOCs, the course is free, but the credit is not. Courses, credits, and services can be bundled or unbundled. The models can be inside-out, outside-in, peer-to-peer, free, or freemium. We created these technologies. When everything is connected, the possibilities are endless. We can change learning experiences, catalyze new forms of scholarship, design new institutions, and interconnect with a world made better by education. We are creating the connected age.
Connecting is a very powerful word, isn't it? It's what we do. We connect data, networks, and people. It's who we are. We're a connected community. And it's what this conference is all about, connecting people and ideas. And if we can create these technologies that connect everyone, imagine what else we can do with technology to improve higher education and to benefit society. We truly believe we can improve higher education in the connected age. Now, our keynote speaker today, Jane McGonigal, knows all about innovation, uncommon thinking, and creating connected learning. But before I introduce Jane, I'd like to thank Follett Higher Education Group for their support of this morning's conference. Follett is supporting today's keynote, and representing Follett is Gary Shapiro. Gary, please stand and be recognized. Thank you all for your generous support. And now Jane McGonigal. Many of you know Jane and are fans of hers. And as you know, she is a world-renowned game designer. But not just any kind of games. She designs games that make a difference in real-world problems and make a difference to the players. She has a PhD in the psychology of games from UC Berkeley. She is a New York Times best-selling author. She has been named as one of the 100 most creative business leaders by Fast Company. She has all kinds of accolades, achievements, and awards, all the way from Oprah Winfrey to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Her research is published in the Harvard Business Review and by MIT Press. And she firmly believes that game designers are on a humanitarian mission. And she hopes that one day, a game designer will receive the Nobel Prize. So would you please join me in welcoming Jane McGonigal.
Good morning, good morning. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for welcoming today. We get to do something really unusual today, which is why I'm so excited. We get to spend the next hour taking games seriously, okay, which is not something we normally do, right? We normally think of games as being, you know, fun but kind of trivial, a way to pass the time or maybe waste a lot of time. But today, we are going to take games seriously as a platform for inventing the future of higher education. Now, before we get to all of the possibilities for the future of higher education, I want to start by sharing some good news with you. Are you ready for some good news? Okay, here it comes, right up here. 1 billion gamers worldwide. Humanity has recently achieved this critical milestone. This is 1 billion people who spend at least an hour a day playing video games. Some of you look a little less excited about this news than I was anticipating. That's okay, I understand. Some people see this number as a little overwhelming, and I can understand why. I mean, people who worry that games are a waste of time, that we're putting too much time into these games, they do have some, fairly persuasive evidence on their side. For example, the fact that we currently spend 300 million minutes a day playing Angry Birds. We've spent 400,000 years in total so far avenging this terrible crime. You know, the bad piggies stole the eggs and the birds got mad and then we got mad on their behalf and we're still mad. That's a lot of time. And if you think about other kinds of games, for example, the Call of Duty games, the average player of these games spends 170 hours every single year playing just this one game. So that's the equivalent of a month of full-time work. Every single year, every Call of Duty player is spending a month of full-time work playing just this one game. And in fact, recently, with the latest release of the Call of Duty series, 1 in 4 players actually called in sick to stay home and play on launch day. They stayed home from work, they stayed home from school. People are playing games like it's their job. How can this be? There is some good research to shed light on this phenomenon. For example, Gallup engagement research, starting at the workplace. We know that 71% of U.S. workers are not engaged. That means when they show up to their jobs, they don't care about what they're doing. They don't feel like they are connected to a higher purpose or meaning. They don't feel like their skills are being developed. They don't feel like they're part of a meaningful community. So they just don't care. They don't have passion for their work. And Gallup estimates that this costs United States companies $300 billion annually in lost productivity Okay, and that's just productivity. Imagine the loss in terms of innovation. If people don't care about their job, they're not going to be able to be creative and really invent something wonderful for the future. And this engagement gap starts long before people get to the workplace. It starts in our schools. In the United States, the longer you stay in school, the less engaged you become. This is a troubling trend line. It starts off in elementary school. 8 out of 10 kids say they're engaged. They are optimistic about their chances for success. They care about what they're learning. They're having fun. They're enjoying the learning process. By the time they get to middle school, only 6 out of 10 students still feel optimistic about their chances for success or still feel like they care about learning. And by the time they get to high school, we're down to 4 in 10 students feel like there's any purpose to what they're doing. Only 4 in 10 students feel like it matters what they do at school. 6 out of 10 say it doesn't matter at all. It has no relevance to their life. They have no hope for the outcome of their education. 6 out of 10 students in the United States. So that's not a great trend line and not a great way to set people up for success in higher education. When you look at these engagement gaps, both at the workplace and in our schools, what you see is this desire for a better way to engage, a way to engage wholeheartedly in challenges that are difficult but not impossible, in challenges that help us develop our skills and abilities and connect us to a community that we are really excited to become a part of. And so, you know, we're stuck with these 7 billion hours a week of people looking for maximum engagement. They're not finding it at work or schools. They're finding it in video games. Why? What is it about video games that makes them such a better source of engagement than our typical schools or workplaces? Well, I've been researching this question for more than a decade. There is a lot of great science, but the number one research finding that I think is most important to understand why games are becoming this ultimate platform of engagement is this: the 10 positive emotions of gaming. If you ask gamers why they play their favorite games, or what they feel when they play their favorite games, this is what you come up with. This is a result of research from several years, thousands of gamers worldwide, and they're the 10 positive emotions of gaming. This is why we play games, because we want to feel joy. We want to feel relief, usually from feelings of loneliness or frustration or anger or boredom. We want to feel love. Now, this is surprising to a lot of people who maybe you're used to thinking of games as being violent, so they must somehow, I don't know, make us hate other players, bring out the worst in us. Or you think of games as being really competitive, so you imagine that people who play together wind up maybe not liking each other so much. But it turns out today, 3 out of 4 gaming hours are actually spent playing cooperative games. So these are games where people are on the same side, they're on the same team, they're trying to achieve a goal together, and this actually builds incredible social bonds and trust and rapport. So love is actually one of the top emotions we feel when we play these multiplayer games. Gamers want to feel surprise, they want to feel pride, they want to feel like they're getting better at something, they're leveling up their skills. They want to feel curiosity, what's going to happen next in the story or in the world. They want to feel excitement, you know, that sense of adrenaline that really gets our interest up. They want to feel awe and wonder, you know, a part of something bigger than themselves. They want to be inspired by a heroic narrative, or they want to be a part of a massively multiplayer community. They want to feel contentment. That just means they're happy with what they're doing. They wouldn't rather be doing anything else. I mean, you never see a gamer, you know, checking their text messages while they're playing, right? Their focus is totally on what they're doing. But the number one thing that gamers say they want to feel when they play their favorite games, and this is really interesting, is creativity. They want a sense of creative agency. They want to feel like they can try something that no one has tried before. They can think outside the box. They can be playful. They can experiment. They can take risks. They might fail, but it's safe to fail, and it's easy to learn from mistakes so that you can get better and try again. And that sense of creative agency is the number one thing that gamers are looking for when they play. Now, Being a gamer myself, I know these positive emotions pretty well, and you may know them well too, but I thought, just to be sure, wouldn't it be nice if we could have a real experience of all 10 of these positive emotions together? And the best way that I can think to give you a firsthand experience of all 10 of these positive emotions in roughly 60 seconds or less is to teach you how to play one of my favorite games. And it's a special game because in order to play it, I need to gather together at least several hundred of my closest friends and family. And it's really hard to do that on a typical weekend. So when I come to an event like this, I think, oh, the perfect opportunity to play my favorite game. So it's win-win for both of us. I get to play my favorite game, and you get to feel all 10 of these positive emotions. So without further ado, I'd like to teach you guys how to play massively multiplayer thumb wrestling. Do we have any experienced players of this game? We actually have a few. Look at this. You see, I'm not just inventing this. People have played this game before. Excellent. Okay, so in order to teach you this game, I'm going to need a few volunteers to come up. Would you mind just running up to the stairs? You know, five or six people. We've got one, two, three, four, five, six. Great. Okay, if you're standing up and coming up, you're on your way. Okay, so massively multiplayer thumb wrestling is a game for the gamer generation. Gamers want to be challenged, right? They want to have to be creative. We're going to go back here. Okay, so the first thing we need to know about massively multiplayer thumb wrestling is that we need more thumbs. So should we, this is Jacob. Jacob's from University of Washington. Let's show them normal thumb wrestling, right? You know, guys know one, two, three, four, I declare thumb war, and then we wrestle, and Jacob won. Okay, good job. So that's the normal game. But we're gamer generation. We can go crazy here. So the first thing is we need more thumbs. So Jacob, why don't we have Peter here? Oh, also from University of Washington. You guys are awesome. Can you guys see? Yeah, so we would have at least three thumbs together, and the first person to pin someone else's thumb will win this hand. So now this is very important. This is the trickiest rule that gets some people a little bit mixed up. It's not the person on top, right? Like if you guys went down and I went on top, I don't win because that's, you know, I'm wait over here, you do all the hard work. It's actually the first person to pin. So in this case, Peter would win. He's the first person to pin. So shall we try it? Okay, one, two, three, go. Oh, and Jacob wins again. I can see Jacob's going to be very good at this game. Okay, awesome. So if we take a look at the slides again, you can see, you know, you can have four in a thumb, and you don't have to limit your ambitions. You can really go for it, okay? So I'll leave it to you how challenged you want to be. Now, the other thing about gamers, you know, we're challenged. I mean, this is challenging, but we can do more, and I happen to notice you both still have thumbs free. So why don't we get some other people involved? We've got Michelle here and Tambra. Yeah, come on in here. And then maybe you guys would reach out and grab from Scott and Dave, and I don't know, you guys want to reach around and try and, you know. Okay, and throw it in there. All right, so before we've even started wrestling, we've already won because we have every thumb connected. This is the co-op win condition. And what I have in, well, we'll see what I have in mind in a minute. But so now we would try and wrestle both thumbs at the same time. So should we give them a little sneak preview? All right, let's just try and go. Okay. Hey, I think I won that hand, but I lost to that hand. Okay, good. So you guys sort of see how that goes. You're our expert players now. So when you go out, make sure you give people credit. So thank you guys for volunteering. And before we get started on our game, let me just teach you a little bit more about this game. So what we're going to do, just so you can get ready, we're going to try and connect every thumb in this room in one node. So I know the room's set for about 5,500 people. If we succeed, this will be one of the top three highest scores for this game ever set anywhere in the world, okay? So that's pretty awesome. So we can have a high score. It's a world record. I think it would be number three highest ever done. And we're all going to do it by connecting our thumbs. But just so you know what you're getting into, because this is my favorite game, I want to tell you a little bit about it. There are levels of difficulty. So this is like the normal level of difficulty. You can see a very easy version. This particular version is called the Death Star configuration. So if you're, you know, science fiction fantasy fan, you'll get that. This is called the Mobius loop. So you guys know Mobius, it loops back on itself. So you can see that one there. And the hardest level is this one. I think EDUCAUSE 2014 will feature an evening event in which we all try to do this one, but we're going to do together. This is a normal version to start, and you have to make sure there are no little pockets, so we want to reach across the aisles. If you're on the end of an aisle, you sort of have a special job, because we want every thumb in the room connected into the same node. You're going to wrestle both thumbs at the same time, but not till I say go, so we're not going to start till we see every thumb. So I'm going to get you stand up, make the node, and then when I say go, we'll wrestle. Good, looking good, looking good. We got a couple of people in there. Stand on up. Don't be afraid to join the game. Okay. If you have a free thumb, wave it around. Make sure people see. Okay, grab that thumb. Grab it. Any others still free? Any other thumbs not connected? I don't see. I think you guys are good. You guys are good. Okay. On the count of three, you're going to wrestle both thumbs. Try to keep track of what you won. One, two, three, go. You won? You got it? Good? You got it? Nice. Nice. Excellent. Good job. Good job. Woo! Well done. Well done. Okay. I love it. Congratulations on a top three world record. Let's do a quick recap on these 10 positive emotions, see how we did. We'll start with curiosity. I said massively multiplayer thumb wrestling, and you were like, what the hell is she talking about? That sounds crazy. So get a little curiosity provoked. Creativity. So it actually requires a little bit of creativity to figure out how to make the connections. I mean, is it this hand or that hand? And should we go upside down or go behind? So in order to get all the thumbs connected, we took the creativity. So well done on that problem solving. That's the hardest part of the game. How about surprise? So the feeling of wrestling two thumbs at once is actually pretty unusual, right? So you have a little bit of surprise. You start to see how that goes. Excitement. As you start to really wrestle and you're like, oh, hey, I'm pretty good at this, or oh, that person's really into it, or you get a little bit of excitement going. Joy is a strong word. You'd have to play this game, I think, a few more rounds to get to joy, but let's say we started with a little bit of happiness or delight. I see you guys were smiling and laughing, which is great. Relief, you got to stand up and kind of get some physical relief from just sort of sitting still and having to listen to somebody. So we had a little bit of relief. How about awe and wonder? So, awe and wonder comes from being a part of something bigger than yourself. Is this perhaps the first time at EDUCAUSE that we had almost all of the on-site attendees physically connected, right? I mean, that's pretty awesome, literally, right? And it's way more epic than normal thumb wrestling, massively multiplayer. So we get some awe and wonder going on. Contentment. I didn't see a single one of you players, sending email or anything like that while we were playing. So I feel very good about that one. How about love? So you guys know the neurohormone oxytocin. The more oxytocin you have, the more you like the people around you, the more you want to help them, the more you tend to trust people who are trustworthy. So it turns out that a really good way to increase oxytocin in someone's bloodstream is to get them to hold someone else's hand in a safe environment for at least 6 seconds. So you guys can do the math. You were all holding hands for way more than 6 seconds. So you now have elevated levels of oxytocin in your bloodstream, which means you are neurochemically primed now to want to help each other. So take advantage of this networking effect. It will be true for the next hour or so. So especially if you wrestled with somebody, they are willing to do you a favor now. And for those of you who came up on stage, that's true for me too. So good on you. The last one is pride. So how many of you are like me and you lost both your thumbs? I pretty much always lose both thumbs. Okay, yeah, don't worry because you just learned a new skill, right? Did you have any idea how to play this game before today? No, and now you do, and you learned a skill and you can teach others, and that's a pretty impressive accomplishment. So well done on that. How many of you managed to win just one thumb? All right, I have good news for you. According to the official rules of massively multiplayer thumb wrestling, this makes you a grandmaster of the game. Because there aren't so many people who know how to play, so we have to kind of, you know, escalate the leveling up process, like, compared to chess, which takes, you know, 10 years. You only have to win one thumb once to become a grandmaster of this game. Did any of you manage to win both of your thumbs? Nice. Oh, nice. I love it when women are raising their hands. That's too good. So the really amazing news here is, get ready to update Facebook and Twitter, is you are legendary grandmasters now for life. So, very good. If you would like to become a legendary grandmaster sometime, the next time you play this game, here's the best strategy that I've worked out. You've got your two thumbs, you know, different. Make sure you're in two different nodes. You're not just obviously wrestling. You can't beat yourself. Okay, so you're in two different nodes. And try and figure out which hand looks weaker. You know, maybe, you know, they just look like they're not paying attention, or they're not going to be really into it. So focus on that one first and do something crazy with this hand so nobody can win. And then as soon as you've got this one figured out, then you suddenly stop moving, swoop in for the kill, and you are a legendary grandmaster. So it's very good. Good. So the reason why we like provoking these 10 positive emotions is not just that they feel good in the moment, but they actually change how we think and act for up to 24 hours later. It turns out that if you can experience 3 positive emotions for every 1 negative emotion over the course of an hour, a day, or a week, you develop a really remarkable resilience. This is one of my favorite areas of psychological research, and also medical research, actually, because it has tremendous benefit for physical health, too. But it's called the 3-to-1 ratio, and any source of positive emotion counts. And if you get above this 3-to-1 ratio, suddenly you become more optimistic, you become more ambitious, you have more energy to do hard work, and you become likable to others, so they're more likely to offer you support, to give you resources or give you encouragement. And it sets up this sort of incredible chances for success. But you have to get the ratio at least 3-to-1. There is an upper limit. It turns out that if you are achieving 13 or more positive emotions for every 1 negative emotion, the whole thing collapses on itself. And the reason why, if you look in the scientific literature, they will tell you is that other people start to hate you because you're really annoying to be around when you're that happy all the time. So keep it in the safe range, 13 to 1 or below, 3 to 1. And so these positive emotions, because we feel them all the time when we play, they're the reason why we play. It turns out that people who spend a lot of time playing these video games actually develop this 3 to 1 resilience, and they're able to bring this resilience back into their real lives. And so I just want to talk now about what it would be like for learning if we had access to these positive emotions while we were trying to learn difficult material, or while we were trying to master difficult skills. And to give you a better sense of what I mean by gamer resilience, I thought I would show you a portrait series of gamers while they're playing their favorite games. And I think if you look very closely, you'll be able to see resilience on their faces. So this is a camera set up by the screen, so you can really see the gamer experience. And you do have to look closely because it's very subtle, but I think you can do it. So here we go. Good. Okay, so what would you call this? You call this relish, right? He's leaning in with that when the tongue comes out of the mouth. Positive emotion researchers will tell you that this means that you are enjoying the challenge, that you feel powerful and capable. So that's what's going on there. This one I love. We call this sort of grit and determination, right? She's literally leaning in to the challenge of the game. This guy. This really shows you that games are hard work. I mean, boy, forget that old bias about how games are easy or gamers are lazy. You can see how hard gamers are working here. And we would call this maybe grit or perseverance, right, what's going on there. This face, this is the flow face. You know, I'm sure you're all familiar with that theory of a flow, that optimal state of challenge and engagement. And that's when we lose track of time. We feel like we can stay in this space forever. This guy's my favorite. You may have seen him before. I love him because if you didn't know he was playing a game, I think you'd be pretty worried about him. The nostrils are flared. The pupils are dilated. But the great thing about having access to those 10 positive emotions anytime, any place, and then therefore building up your resilience so that you're more optimistic, you're more motivated, you're more determined, you're less likely to give up when things get rough, you're better able to draw on social support and allies and collaborators. When you have all of those gamer types of resilience, You're not going to give up when things are going as badly as they are in the photo that you can see. Let's pull that guy's video, because I want you to really get the impression here. I think this is like the before picture where he's going to fail again and again. And in fact, gamers fail 80% of the time, 4 out of 5 times, and they don't give up. And think how different that is from our current educational system, where failure can be permanent and you're desperately afraid of it and you really pay for it. Games, you fail 4 out of 5 times, but you have all this emotional, positive emotional resilience. So you go from a face like this. I think this is guys like the before picture, and this guy would be like the after picture, right? The sort of sense of surprise and wonder at what you're able to accomplish. I mean, this guy has been successful in the game, and he looks surprised. He looks like maybe he achieved something that he didn't think was possible for himself. And when I look at all these faces, you know, what I really think is that the opposite of play isn't work, which we've been told for years and years and years that the opposite of play is work, but it's not, right? The opposite of play is really depression. When we're depressed, we are pessimistic about our own capabilities, and we don't have energy to engage with things that are difficult. But when we play, we have all the energy in the world. We're constantly creating more energy. You've seen gamers who come home from a tough day of school or work, and they're exhausted, and they sit down to play. And then 5 hours later, they have more energy than it's as if they just had, you know, 12 coffees, because the positive emotions are so energizing. And we are so optimistic about our capabilities. You will never see a gamer sit down in front of a game saying, you know, oh, I'm going to be terrible at this. There's no way I'm going to win. I'm going to be the worst player ever. When we play a game, we sit down. We're like, all right, let's do this. I'm ready. I'm going to get good. I'm going to win. I'm going to get the highest score ever. That is the natural sort of optimistic trajectory of gaming, because of the emotional resilience we build through those 10 positive emotions. And the cool thing is, this idea, you know, that the games are the opposite of depression, it makes a sort of intuitive sense. But now, thanks to advances in neuroscience, we can start to see that neurologically, gameplay is literally the opposite of depression. Okay, so I want to show you now some scans of game brains. So you know, this is like your brain on games. And what we are finding out is that when you are playing a video game, the parts of your brain that become extremely activated, very excited, are literally the exact same parts of the brain that are underexcited and underactivated in people who are struggling with depression. Okay, so let's take a look at some fMRI footage. You can actually see what this looks like. If we can bring up that video. So this is the gamer in an fMRI machine. These images were taken at Stanford University, and they wanted to see if they could account somehow neurologically for this incredible optimism and energy effects that we see in gamers. And so, by the way, it's very complicated to get a PlayStation controller in an fMRI machine without blowing it up. So congratulations to Stanford University for figuring that one out. You can see from the slides up here that there was a pretty big difference between people who were playing games and people who were not playing games. Just if you've ever had the bias that games or video games are going to turn kids into brain-dead zombies, I mean, whose brain looks like the brain-dead zombie here? It's not the person playing the game, right? It's the person watching the game being played. And this is kind of cool to notice. This passive condition, they're actually watching a video game. So they're seeing all the cool graphics, and they're hearing the sound effects, and they're following the story. But look at how much less brain activity there is. It turns out you have to be in control of the game. It is your agency in the game that activates the parts of the brains that we associate with optimism, with the opposite of depression, with motivation and hard work. And in fact, you can see that when they sort of zoomed in to find the areas that were super activated by gameplay. There were two parts that were going crazy every time the gamer made an attempt to do something, to achieve a goal or have an impact on the world. So the super lighting up you see here, this wasn't constant. It would light up right after they took an action, you know, right after they aimed and fired their weapon, or right after they tried to solve the puzzle, they made a move, right? Every time they tried, the brain went crazy in this really positive way. And the first part, the caudate and thalamus, that's the motivation center of the brain. That's the reward center. It's a part of the brain that we also associate with addiction, which is why you may have seen heads headlines like video games activate the same part of the brain as cocaine. It's true, they do. Because this part of the brain is associated with not giving up when we want something. So the more this part of the brain is lit up, the more singularly focused we are on achieving our goal. In the case of addiction, that's getting what we're addicted to. But in the case of learning, we are singularly focused and dedicated to mastering this skill, to solving this puzzle, to getting to the next level of work. And so we love to see this part of the brain lit up when somebody's trying to, you know, learn a language or become a, you know, virtuoso violin player, they're training for a marathon, they're doing something that is personally ambitious and important. It means the more this part of the brain is lit up, the less likely you are to give up when things get tough. So this is the motivation part of gaming. And we know that this part of the brain gets activated just by giving gamers a goal and saying, are you ready? If you opt in to this goal, you choose to pursue this goal, the motivation part of the brain starts going. The anticipation of reward starts going. So that's where that part of the brain gets activated, because every game has a goal. And the hippocampus is going crazy too when you play. The hippocampus is a part of the brain associated with learning. And the more this part of the brain is activated, the more likely you are to remember new information you're exposed to, or to continue to practice a habit that you've been developing, or to be able to recall an emotion that you were feeling at a certain time and to feel that again in the future. And why does this part of the brain go crazy when we're playing a game? Well, every game, you are designed to be bad at it when you start, right? The experience of playing a game is the experience of figuring out how the game works, how to get good at it, and when we get good at it, we usually stop playing unless we're really competitive and we just love to win. Most people stop playing a game when it gets boring. It's why grown-ups don't play tic-tac-toe. Once you learn how the game works and you can always win or get to a draw, you stop playing. And whenever we have to learn something new, whenever we have to get better at something, the hippocampus is going. Now, the folks at Stanford have hypothesized this would make games a really powerful kind of one-two punch for learning, because you have incredible motivation, that the players are less likely to give up if they fail, more likely to hang in there when things get tough. And you also have the hippocampus activated. So in addition to learning to be better at the game, they will also be better able to remember information they were exposed to, or better able to continue to practice the skills that they were developing in the game in the future. So I like to think of this as really showing us what it means to have the brain of a super empowered, hopeful individual. And isn't that what we want our students to be? To be super empowered and hopeful about their own ability to succeed in learning. And this brain's chemistry of games, I think this starts to explain why you're seeing so much interest now in gamification and learning. Things like giving points for completing missions that are really like, you know, homework activities, and giving people achievement badges as they master new skills, and having more clearly defined levels so they can see themselves advancing to their degree better. All of these things, the points, the levels, the achievement badges, they give the learners a new goal so we can get that activation of the reward and motivation center going, clearly defined goals that feel like it's possible to achieve them. And the constant feedback that we're getting is helping us feel we are getting better, we are learning, and that's part of that process of wanting to get better that gets the hippocampus going. So that's why you see, I think, the sort of early days of gamification, there is a lot of benefit to things like points, levels, achievement badges. But I'm also interested in how we can take this further. For the future of higher education is going to go a lot further than the gamification we're seeing today in terms of harnessing the power of video games. And I'm particularly interested in the fact that we have 1 billion gamers worldwide, and they're playing on connected devices. So this is the age of connected learning. What if we were able to bring all of these gamers together into a learning ecosystem? What could they accomplish? What could they do? And it really makes me think about something that Joey Ito talks about a lot. He's the director of the MIT Media Lab now. He's always ahead of the technology curve and has such great foresight. And he said recently, I don't think education is about centralized instruction anymore. It's about the process of establishing yourself as a node in a broad network of distributed creativity. So this idea that students should not be receiving instruction, but that they should be creating learning, right? I think this is a talk about flipping the classroom. This is flipping our concept. Should students be learning knowledge that is already known, or should they be creating knowledge? Should they be creating insight? Should they be solving problems that nobody has solved before as part of their education? And I'm really committed to this idea. I don't like the idea that college is a safe space, you know, apart from the rest of the world, and it's sort of a pause between, you know, growing up and real life. And when you get out of school, that's when you really start to change the world, when you really start to get your hands dirty in doing something that's real and matters. I think we can start engaging students much earlier in solving real problems and doing real work. So with my remaining time, I want to share with you three projects that I think do a great job of showing how we can bring these 1 billion super empowered, hopeful individuals, and there'll be many more over the coming decade. We should be up to 2 or 3 billion by the end of the decade, and how we can give them a way to play a role, to become a node in this broad network of distributed creativity. And let's be directly inspired by games here. So you guys know Tetris, right? Tetris is a game that most of us have played at some point, and people who are really into Tetris have developed this incredible kind of spatial intelligence skill. They're really good about fitting different pieces together. What if we could take that gamer superpower and use it to solve real scientific problems? So I got to thumb wrestle with some folks from the University of Washington just a bit earlier. They are really on the forefront of leveraging these gamer skills. This was a platform created by the University of Washington. It's called Foldit. You may have seen it. It's a really great platform for teaching ordinary people who do not have PhDs or MDs how to do protein folding in a virtual environment, which is one way to look for new cures for diseases like cancer or Alzheimer's. And the thinking was that gamers have such good spatial intelligence, they could manipulate these proteins in the virtual space and maybe be better at it than supercomputers, where, you know, for years scientists have been having computers kind of brute force the research process. Because protein folding, it's kind of like playing with a Rubik's Cube with 100,000 sides. If you can imagine the kind of existential horror of having to solve and get all the things lined up for 100,000 sides, I can't, honestly, can't do the 9 sides. So they were thinking computers should do this, and we'll just kind of brute force it. But wait, gamers have great spatial intelligence. They are very collaborative, so they'll sort of teach each other what they're learning as they go, sort of make each other better. They're not going to give up because they have all this resilience. So they created this game platform, and this is what it looks like. And you know, I will concede that this is more complicated interface than Candy Crush Saga or Angry Birds, but it is not more complex than World of Warcraft, so you should not be intimidated by this. And you learn how to do it, and you try to solve problems, and the first thing that happened is that the researchers proved that the gamers were definitely better than the computers. In fact, they beat the computers on a majority of virtual protein folding puzzles that the scientists knew solutions to. So they gave gamers and they gave the computers the same set of puzzles, and the gamers were able to figure it out faster. So this was so exciting. They actually published a paper in Nature Journal. You can see up here that they've actually listed the players, at this time it's about 50,000 players, by name as co-authors on a peer-reviewed paper in Nature Journal, the most prestigious scientific journal. Now, I have a PhD, and I don't have any credits in Nature Journal, so I did not start playing this game soon enough. But there's hope for, I think, a collaborative Nobel Prize in the future, because you may have seen these headlines. When scientists fail, it's time to call in the gamers. Gamers unlock protein mystery that baffled AIDS researchers for years. So they started to give the players real puzzles that no one had solved before. And in fact, they gave them a puzzle that HIV researchers had been working on for 10 years. And the gamers solved it in 10 days. So this was an incredible accomplishment. And in fact, their teams of players at colleges and high schools and even middle schools all around the world, the team that made that final fold, that everything clicked into place, was a high school in the UK. So students directly responsible for solving a scientific problem that had stumped professional scientists for a decade. It's very exciting. Now, the next project I want to show you tries to connect with a goal that many students have that they say is not being fulfilled in high school or college environments. If I can have the slides back up. If you ask students in the United States what they want to do with their lives, 43% say they want to start their own business. And 42% say that they believe they will someday invent something that changes the world. Now, that is an incredible amount of optimism. I mean, that's the millennial gamer generation right there. That 42% of young people believe that they will someday invent something that changes the world. But interestingly, these are the two life goals or aspirations that most students say they are not being prepared for in an educational environment. So the next project is an attempt to kind of change that, to give a hands-on learning for starting business or changing the world. And you can say that this game was inspired by some of the open world story games, mission games, like Grand Theft Auto, which I know you're thinking, that sounds like a terrible inspiration for an educational game, and in many ways it would be. But what's great about Grand Theft Auto is you get to explore the whole world and interact with all kinds of people, and you never know what you'll be asked to do. And the sort of sense of freedom to explore and to interact with the world around you was something we were trying to emulate in this project. The project was called Evoke. It was created with the World Bank Institute, which is the learning arm of the World Bank. And this was designed as a way to teach young people social entrepreneurship skills, how to start a small business that could also solve a social problem like hunger or poverty or climate change or education for girls, and do it in a way that is profitable enough to make a sustainable living. So I will show you a trailer for the game and then I'll explain how it worked.
Exist. How do we contact them?
You have to send an evoke.
Show me. My name is Alchemy, and this is an urgent evoke. Wherever you are, whoever you are, if you found this message, it's your destiny to join us. Humanity needs our help. A problem and you can't solve it alone, evoke it.
So that's urgentevoke.com. The platform is free and online and still available if you think you might want to use this with your school or organization. So let me tell you a little bit about how this game worked. We created this social network, the Evoke social network, and the centerpiece was a graphic novel. The graphic novel told stories set 10 years in the future where the rest of the world was going through extreme crises, the world outside of Africa. And it was young people from sub-Saharan Africa who were kind of called on to be superheroes for the rest of the world. So when there was famine in Tokyo, it was folks who had been dealing with food security in Africa who came to rescue them. When there was an outbreak of cholera in London in the River Thames, it was folks who'd been working on water safety in Africa who came to help. And we told this story because we heard when we talked to young people, and by the way, we were focusing first as an audience on university students or university age students in sub-Saharan Africa. And we heard from them that they just didn't see themselves as the type of person to really be able to tackle these kinds of major epic challenges. So we wanted to tell a story where we could show them that maybe, in fact, there was a way to become the heroes for the rest of the world. And we knew this was working when a high school student, a girl, said to us during the playtesting after looking at these stories, "This was the first time in my life that I ever thought that Africa could be the source of the world's greatest solutions and not just the source of all the world's biggest problems." So you can really use gaming and narrative to kind of change people's sense of what's possible. So every week they would come to the game. It was optimized for mobile phones. You could also play online. And they would answer one question about their origin story. Now, you know, every superhero has an origin story, like Peter Parker got bit by a radioactive spider. That's how he became Spider-Man. We wanted to know how you would go from being an ordinary person to being someone capable of running a business and changing the world. So we asked you one question each week that you would answer, things like, what are you better at than, you know, all of your friends and family? Tell us three things that you're better at or know more than all of your friends and family. And what's your, you know, what's the spark that drives you? What's the problem in your neighborhood or your city or community that really gets you most motivated? Who would your dream allies be? If you were making the Avengers for your real life, who would you want to work with and what other skills would you need? At the end of the 10 weeks, they had all this information in a media-rich environment that could be used as a way to attract collaborators or mentors or allies or even investors in a business plan. We gave them a real-world mission every single week where they had to go out into the real world and explore and try to use some of the skills we were teaching them through the online content, through videos and blog posts. So, for example, the week that we looked at famine in Tokyo, they had to go out and improve the food security of at least one person in their community. And they would use blog posts and photos and videos, so all kinds of social media, to prove that they were actually going out there and doing these missions. So here's somebody, the week that we were doing food security, went out and started a little urban farm, and here's all the photos of him actually doing this. And this was somebody who, the week we looked at energy, decided to convert his bike to become a way to charge friends and family small electronics through the kinetic power of riding the bike around town. Other players would do peer feedback and give you plus ones in different categories of evoked powers or skills, things like entrepreneurship or courage or sustainability or resourcefulness, because we couldn't look at all of the content ourselves, so we had the students evaluate each other, and this is what one student's profile would look like at the end of the game. He has, you know, plus 186 knowledge share, plus 254 creativity. At the end of the 10 weeks, if you completed all 10 origin story quests and all 10 of these real-world missions as documented through your social media, the World Bank Institute declared you a social innovator. Class of 2010, the first time we ran this, you actually got a certificate from the World Bank Institute. And we heard from students this is what they wanted, something formal that they could point to for their success. Now, we were originally hoping to enroll about 500 students from sub-Saharan Africa, and this is the first time we ran this course, 10 weeks. We actually wound up enrolling just under 20,000 students from more than 130 countries. So I like to think of us as being one of the first MOOCs, but nobody was using that word yet. But we sort of accidentally ran a MOOC, not on purpose, but people saw the trailer and they showed up. That was how we found people for the game. So as you know, people all over the world, including in the United States, really wanted to learn this sort of crash course in changing the world. What I'm most proud of is at the end of the 10 weeks, more than 50 student teams had succeeded so much in putting together a vision and learning these skills and coming up with a business idea that the World Bank Institute funded 50 new social enterprises that these students had created for the game. We were able to partner with Global Giving to raise even more money for them. Things like libraries across Africa. This was one of my favorite results from the game. They decided to make libraries more like McDonald's, which doesn't sound good the first time you hear it, that idea. But what they were thinking was, McDonald's are franchises that seem to spread across the globe like a super virus, whereas libraries seem to have a hard time spreading across Africa. What if we could invent a franchise model for libraries where we could help people make a profit selling snacks, charging people electronics, but making the library resources free for the community otherwise? And this is up and running. The first library is being built in Ghana now. Students who played a game and are now running libraries in Ghana. Pretty impressive. So what if we could help students write the future? What if we could help them invent the future in other ways through writing? And this game was inspired a little bit by MMORPGs, these role-playing games like World of Warcraft, where you have lots of players come together at the same time to work on a collaborative quest together. They're all going to go on a raid together. They're all going to try to accomplish a really epic mission together on one night. So I thought, what if we could bring a lot of people together to a really awe-inspiring space, but instead of it being a virtual space, it could be a physical space. And the space that we picked was the New York Public Library, the downtown branch, this beautiful building, which if you've seen Ghostbusters, it's the one that gets slimed in that movie. And we wanted to see if we could bring people and get them more excited about writing and more excited about libraries, being in libraries in general. And one of the things that really inspired me in creating this game was the research that 82% of young Americans say that they want to write a book someday. Now, of course, nowhere near 82% want to read a book, but almost all young people feel like they have something important to say, and they want to have a voice in the world, and they think that writing a book would be good. So that what if we could make a game where by playing the game, you actually write a book? That would be pretty cool. And I wasn't sure I could pull it off, so I had the library send me some materials and to see, you know, what would we do? Could we do a video game here? And they sent me this diagram of how they store books at the library. This diagram is from 1911. It was published in Scientific America. And it shows that there are actually 8 levels of books underneath the city streets of Manhattan. In fact, they go for miles underneath the city streets. This is kind of incredible. If you don't know this, true story, you are like walking above books when you walk around New York City. It's pretty cool. And as soon as I saw this, I knew I could make a game because, do you guys see it? It's like basically Donkey Kong already, right? So the game that we made, it was an 8-level game, just like there are 8 levels of books. And when you get to the top level, you have written a real book that will be printed on demand and put in the actual stacks of the library. You'll be a published author with the New York Public Library. So let's watch the trailer, and then I'll tell you how it worked. What we did is we invited people to apply to be the first people, the first 500 people to play this game. The game would be playable for a full year at the New York Public Library. There would also be an online version. So if you couldn't make it to the library, you could play online. But we wanted to kick it off with this incredible adventure. So we had people write essays online to apply to play this game. And what was really interesting, after we put that trailer online, one of the members of the board of directors for the library came up to me at a meeting and was very nervous. And she said, you know, this could be potentially embarrassing. You have just publicly committed us to convincing 500 young people to spend a Friday night at the library. This seems unlikely, and what will we do when nobody comes? But we actually had more than 10,000 young people apply for those 500 spots, and we picked 500 of them. Here they come pouring in through the doors on Friday night. We are going to lock those doors 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., sunset to sunrise. No one's allowed out until they write a book. That was our rule. And I'm sure you're wondering, How does playing a game help you write a book? It actually took me 3 months to figure that out. I came up with the idea for the game before I had any idea how it would work, which is always the best way to design one of these games, I think. And we wound up creating this mobile app that would lead you around the library looking for these 100 special objects, objects that had changed history. And you can see them here. They're using their smartphones to wander around and find these objects. Things like the Declaration of Independence, a particular draft that Thomas Jefferson is sort of scribbling things out and changing things at the last minute. And you would use a QR code to prove that you were standing face-to-face with history. And when you were face-to-face with history, we would tell you a secret. For example, about the Declaration of Independence, we would point you to parts that had been scribbled out that were actually criticizing the institution of slavery. And we would show you how, at the last minute, Thomas Jefferson changed his mind. His friend said, "It's too controversial. You're trying to do too much. Take a step back. Just declare our independence. We'll deal with the slavery issue later." And so we wanted to humanize the process of changing the world. We wanted to show that even these amazing accomplishments that just seemed to happen perfectly were actually really fraught, that people were nervous, people were insecure, people were indecisive. Even someone like Thomas Jefferson didn't know, what is the right thing to do? How far is too far? Do I have the courage to say everything that's on my mind? So every object that we gave them an encounter with, we tried to humanize that process of making history so they could understand that they, an ordinary person who might be insecure or afraid, could change history too. The most important part of the game was we gave you a writing quest after you had this encounter with the object, inspired by the object. So for the example of the Declaration of Independence, we asked you to make a declaration, to create your own declaration for today, this day and age. What do you think needs to be declared today? And we asked you to try to get 56 other people to sign your declaration. That's how many people signed the Declaration of Independence. And, you know, to upload the declaration and the signature. So you can see a photo of a player here. He's standing on a table at the Rose Reading Room trying to draw attention so he can get 56 signatures. He wound up writing a declaration of interdependence. This is very millennial, right? And we're too independent. We need to be interdependent and collaborate more. That was how he responded to the quest. And well, we wanted to have a book at the end of the night. So we found this guy in Brooklyn who had been trained in England in medieval bookbinding, and he showed up with this contraption and all this leather, and he was sewing together the book. As the players played the game, they would finish a quest, they would print out their quest, what they had written, and it would go right into the book. And you almost saw it as a progress bar as the book got fatter and fatter as the night went on. This is what the Rose Reading Room looked like at 3 a.m. It never looked like that before. Later, the president of the library told me the only other time they'd had that many young people at the library was when they rented 300 Xboxes and had a Halo tournament. So I think our game was a little more on mission for the library. You're wondering how they stayed up all night. They were very creative. This guy brought a vuvuzela, and he would wander around randomly blowing it, just to make sure nobody was sleeping. Don't try that normally in the library, but if you're playing a game, it's totally cool. At the end of the night, the 500 players had written 1,184 stories. They were all stories about the future they wanted to make, the change they wanted to see happen in the world, the role they personally wanted to play in making a difference. And at 6 a.m., they lined up to hand sign the book as a commitment to making that future a reality. We called it 100 Ways to Make History Volume 1 because this was just the first book written by the game. People could come the rest of the year and write their own books, and people anywhere in the world could write their own books using the same quest but printing them out for their own school or library, which was wonderful. So there are many volumes. But this particular volume, the big epic win for our players, was that originally the board of directors had said they were going to put this book in the general research stacks, just like you saw, the stacks that go underground. And that's where all the, you know, any old book that comes, there's like a new biography of Lady Gaga, put it in the general research collection. But they were so impressed by what the players created that one of the board members stood up and said to everybody at 6 a.m., "The New York Public Library pledges to defend your book for as long as New York City is standing. And we will keep this book in the rare books collection next to the Declaration of Independence, next to a Gutenberg Bible." So these are, not only are they published authors in the New York Public Library catalog, they're the only living authors of something in the rare books collection. They have access to that collection for the rest of their lives to bring their kids and bring their grandkids, which I think is pretty cool. Okay, my time is up, but I wanted to share something with you that I've never shared with anyone before, because this is EDUCAUSE, and it's huge, and it's exciting, and I was so honored to be invited. So I'm going to take 3 more minutes of your time, if you will be so generous, to show you where I think all of this is going. I like to make these games that connect people all over the world, and sometimes they look like MOOCs, and sometimes they look like, you know, special events. But I think in the future, we're going to see the MOOCs, and we're going to see the live events, and we're going to see ordinary gamification with points, levels, and achievement badges all start to blend into a new way of learning, kind of learning extreme learning environments where you can learn anytime, any place, and it's full of play and collaboration. So I just want to end by showing you a video created by my colleagues at the Institute for the Future. This is a vision for the future of education. And when we think about where games and learning are going, I think it's going to go even further than we've talked about today. And this video will share with you what that future might look like. So let's see that video.
Meet Andy, though you probably already know someone like him. Dreamt of being an architect since seeing the Guggenheim as a kid. Got accepted into a good architecture program at college. And then, something just didn't click. Maybe it was the crowded lectures, or irrelevant exams, or professors who never remembered his name. But Andy was lost on his own. By the time he dropped out to work at the Burger Barn, Andy's dream of being an architect seemed lost. But what if Andy's life followed the same path, only now a few years in the future? Would dropping out of college still be the end of the road? Let's drop into a day in this Andy's life. Rise and shine, Andy! Whether he agrees or not, Andy's circadian body monitor knows it's the right time for him to get up. He's got 15 minutes to get out of bed and pull himself together before it's his optimal time to start studying. But studying lately has become a lot more like discovering. Last spring, Andy got a chance to try out a different route to becoming an architect. He enrolled in a new alternative to school platform called Socrates 2.0. Socrates 2.0 gives Andy lots of learning tools like this question and answer program and other learning games. It tracks his progress and the contributions he makes to the architecture community and awards him level ups when he reaches certain goals. Plus, it's all on his own schedule, so he can still work at Burger Barn to help him pay his way through. Maybe the most important thing Socrates 2.0 gives Andy is Tom, his mentor. Tom's a retired architect, one of the best in the field of urban design.
I know you've been working overtime at the Burger Barn, but I checked your profile. You're still not quite getting this structural integrity stuff. There's a meetup tonight that some of the other students are going to. You may find it helpful. I'm sending it to your calendar now. In the meantime, why don't you get out of the house and take a look at some real buildings?
That's not a building you'd want to be in during an earthquake. Time to see if there are any local projects he can help out on. Andy likes to feel like he's pitching in, and the fact he can level up by contributing doesn't hurt either. Bingo! This one looks perfect. His classmate, Chiaki, could really help on the site history side, so he posts it to her profile to see if she wants to join. As usual, the room is buzzing. There's always a great mix at the meetup. Professional architects, hobbyists, scientists, academics, and students like Andy. There are plenty of people Andy would love to talk to here, but his time is limited. He's heard that Leslie Haverford was part of the Back to the Land movement in her youth. He has a hunch she'll be able to give him a fresh perspective on the relationship between nature and architecture.
What can't architects learn from nature, Andy? You know who designs the best self-cooling homes? Termites! Or take our own bodies as an example. The way that muscles and cartilage provide continuous pull, and the bones, discontinuous push, that's like the best way to build a bridge. That's the most stable structure.
Andy's gotta get home. His circadian body clock is giving him 45 minutes to get to bed. Just when things were getting good, too. The conversation with Leslie was just the kind of thing Andy wasn't getting in college. He's anxious to test out his new knowledge on Socrates 2.0, and he doesn't have a minute to spare. Andy uses his newfound inspiration to plow through as much as he can in his allotted time. Level up! And with only 10 minutes to go. Not bad, Andy. Now pat yourself on the back and enjoy those 10 minutes. It's all you've got until you have to go to bed, get up, and start all over again in the morning.
Good. Well, I hope that provides a kind of interesting glimpse into what the future might be like in this sort of extreme learning IT environment where things can be so personalized, so spontaneous, and really connect students with real work and real social networks where they can feel a part of what they're learning about and actually start to make creative contributions today while they're still in school. This is the future for super empowered, hopeful individuals, people who grew up gaming, who want to explore the world with the same creativity and the same enthusiasm that they do when they explore their favorite virtual worlds. You know, try to take away these 10 positive emotions as really being the cornerstone of what we're trying to create with games. If you can't remember all 10 emotions, just try to remember the faces and this look of determination and enthusiasm for difficult challenges, leaning in wholeheartedly to mastering these new skills. I hope that you will continue to talk with me online about Super Empowered Hopeful Individuals or come to the book signing now. And congratulations on setting one of the top 3 world all-time high scores for massively multiplayer thumb wrestling. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Please join me in giving Jane a big thumbs up for an incredible presentation. Just a reminder, Jane will be doing a book signing in the Follette booth in the exhibit hall. Your next session is lunch and dessert. Please enjoy day 2. Thank you.